Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
That guy Bruce Moll is constantly moving around.
This is WBUR. We're interrupting Here and Now to bring you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House.
Testing on personal protective equipment, hospital capacity, as well as an update on our plans to support the Commonwealth's shelter community and homeless population. We'll also make an announcement around additional support for foster parents. Yesterday, we had a really strong day when it comes to testing, with 8,750 tests conducted and processed. That's the largest number on any single day. That brings us to a total of 140,773 tests conducted in the Commonwealth, and maintains our status as one of the biggest testers on a per capita basis in the country. That's more than double the goal we set for ourselves a few weeks ago. Obviously, as we said back then, with more tests, we would see more positives. There were 2,263 new cases reported yesterday. We'll continue to chase personal protective equipment any way we can and are working hard to get PPE out to frontline workers who need it. And as of yesterday, we've delivered over 4 million pieces of PPE, which includes 2.3 million gloves, over 370,000 aircraft masks, almost 190,000 gowns, and 380 ventilators. There's more that needs to be done here, and we've talked about that a number of times. The command centers communicating daily with hospitals and medical professionals around the Commonwealth to monitor the capacity in our hospitals. And as of the end of yesterday, there are now 18,000 beds available statewide. About 10,260, or 57% of these beds, remain unoccupied and available for patients. These unoccupied beds include about 6,600 acute care or 9 ICU beds, approximately 2,600 ICU beds, and 900 beds at our field medical hospitals. As a reminder, the beds in these field medical hospitals are only intended to be used if they're needed and for patients who have something less than an acute care need. We anticipate that hospital rates will increase in the coming days, especially in our hospitals for patients that need COVID-19 related illnesses to be taken care of. We're seeing an increase in the number of people needing hospital level care, and that is driven in many respects by COVID-19. There's a lot of hard work and good relationships between the command center and our healthcare community across the Commonwealth, and good plans in place to manage this surge. At this point in time, we believe we are doing all the things our medical community is looking for us to do, and that they are doing all the things that we're looking for them to do to keep up with the increase in hospitalization. And for now, we all feel in pretty good shape with respect to this. But that's because everybody's out in the community working hard and doing their job by socially isolating, by washing their hands, by wearing face coverings when they go out or end up in a place where they can't socially distance, and doing the things they need to do to slow the spread. And this is no time to let up. We're also getting daily data from our hospitals so we can keep an accurate inventory of the beds, and that allows us to continue to assess the Commonwealth's needs both statewide and regionally during the surge. I'm also pleased to announce that effective today, the Commonwealth will distribute respirator masks to all local law enforcement officers and firefighters statewide during the COVID-19 response. This includes sheriffs and university police. This has been made possible through some hard work from the COVID Command Center and the folks at MEMA. Starting today, nearly 200,000 masks will be distributed to all communities. MEMA will execute this task through their regional point of distribution model, where communities can pick up supplies at their designated MEMA point of distribution. This distribution is going on as we speak, and tens of thousands of masks have already been distributed to our first responders. MEMA's worked closely with them to determine how many masks each first responder needs. They've worked out a formula where each first responder will receive 5 masks, which is an equivalent to 1 month's supply plus a spare. Our first responders are trained on how and when to use these masks, including how to properly care for them. The new mask allocation, is in addition to the ongoing PPE distribution by MEMA and DPH to hospitals, nursing homes, senior living communities, community health centers, local public safety, emergency management response, state agencies, and other organizations. As of yesterday, the Commonwealth, as I said, had delivered 4 million pieces of PPE statewide. Daily distribution of PPE can be found at mass.gov/COVID-19. I think everybody knows that the challenges of COVID-19 are being especially felt hard in some of our most vulnerable populations, including the homeless. For an estimated 18,000 Massachusetts residents that experience homelessness, COVID-19 is particularly challenging. Massachusetts was among the first states to create designated isolation sites for COVID-positive homeless individuals. This partnership between the state and our homeless shelters and municipalities has been underway for several weeks now. This includes expanded scattered sites for homeless family placements and the development of an expedited PPE distribution process for shelters. This strategy to support homeless individuals and families includes five key initiatives. First goal is to establish regional isolation and recovery sites for COVID-positive individuals. Between state and local efforts, we have over 1,450 beds across the Commonwealth currently available, with the capacity to add beds if we need to. MEMA opened 5 hotels across the state to provide a safe place for people experiencing homelessness so that they could isolate and recover if they've tested positive for COVID-19. These 5 hotels have 550 beds total and are staffed with 24/7 security and nursing staff. We've been working closely with numerous local health systems and community health centers to provide other on-site support services with physical and behavioral health professionals. We've also worked closely with the City of Boston, which has established the East Newton Pavilion and Boston Hope Medical Center location sites in partnership with us, the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless Program, Boston Medical Center, Partners Healthcare, and several other shelters. We are very grateful for the continued partnership we have with Mayor Walsh and the City of Boston to make these locations and services readily available. These 2 isolation sites in Boston have a total of 732 respite beds for homeless individuals who have suspected or confirmed COVID-19. We're also providing technical and logistical support to several municipalities that have established their own isolation solutions, including Chelsea and Revere. As of April 15th, over 160 individuals have been served at one of these sites. Our second goal is to deploy equipment and supplies for local quarantine solutions. We've created an expedited process for homeless shelters and municipalities to request equipment and supplies such as tents, beds, and portable showers. This equipment can be set up as quarantine solutions in places like repurposed school gyms, recreational centers, churches, office buildings, and heated tents. So far, 11 communities have received supplies from MEMA to support their quarantine efforts. These communities include Brockton, Cambridge, Fitchburg, Framingham, Greenfield, Hyannis, Lowell, Southbridge, Taunton, Worcester, and Waltham. We've developed an expedited process for homeless shelters to request PPE and other supplies necessary to maintain appropriate cleaning and sanitation practices in shelters for staff. And as of April 15th, 84 shelter sites have received a robust assortment of supplies from the command center, including masks, face shields, gloves, partitions, temperature strips, hand sanitizer, and cleaning supplies. Each isolation and recovery site is being equipped with sufficient PPE, medical supplies, food, toiletries, and other provisions for all guests, clinical staff, security, and first responders. Our third goal has been to support families in emergency assistance and domestic violence shelters. The Lieutenant Governor will have more to say on this in a few minutes. And lastly, we've been providing technical assistance to organizations and municipalities seeking funding through FEMA's Public Assistance Program. For municipalities and nonprofits, FEMA will reimburse 75% of the costs associated with qualifying quarantine and isolation services for people experiencing homelessness. We've also established a dedicated portal to support municipalities and organizations through the grant application process. As of April 15th, 236 applications have been processed and approved by MEMA, and the Command Center continues to work closely with homeless shelters and local municipalities and will update guidance and supports when appropriate. We're also taking a number of steps to support individuals in the Emergency Assistance Program. The Department of Housing and Community Development is in regular contact with shelter providers and has weekly calls with the community. DHCD has put several pieces of guidance for shelters, including an emergency screening protocol for families with COVID-19, congregate screening protocols, and sharing information on COVID-19 from DPH and CDC guidance with families. We're implementing policies that will allow providers to spread people out more in shelters, and DHCD is working to bring more scattered site apartments online to help with this. We're also working to cut red tape and to give people more options for where they can stay without penalty. Now, if a family in an emergency assistance shelter wants to leave the shelter to go stay with friends or family during this crisis, they're able to do so and they can return to the shelter later without penalty. We'll continue to remain in close contact with shelter providers to make sure they have the resources they need to keep the families within their communities safe. Today, we're also announcing some additional relief for the Commonwealth's foster parents. We know that, like most families in Massachusetts, as a result of school closings and work-from-home recommendations, foster families are incurring increased food, cleaning supply, and utility costs. Everybody knows that foster parents are vital to the Department of Children and Families and its mission to keep kids safe, and as they care for some of the Commonwealth's most vulnerable children who have been abused or neglected. To aid these foster parents who voluntarily care for our children, the department will be making a $100 per child per month reimbursement payment for the months of April, May, and June. Currently, on average, foster parents are reimbursed between $830 and $975 per child per month, depending upon the age of the child in their care. These $100 additional payments represent a 10 to 12% increase over current reimbursements for foster parents. The relief will benefit approximately 4,500 foster families who provide departmental foster care for about 6,700 children. This includes unrestricted and kinship foster families. We anticipate the first payments will be issued later this month. Right now, Massachusetts is going through the surge. We've talked about this before. Many people are sick and hospitalized as they fight this insidious disease. We're bringing every resource we can to the task and calling on our best and brightest here in Massachusetts to help us navigate these difficult waters. This pandemic has required significant sacrifice from us all. Closing businesses and schools, staying home, canceling family events like weddings and funerals, asking our first responders and frontline healthcare workers to go above and beyond to work extra hours and put themselves and their loved ones in harm's way. Yesterday, the president released a template for how the country can begin to think about reopening in a phased approach. The administration has rightly deferred to states to make the best decisions on behalf of their residents. And notably, before any state should consider efforts to slowly return to normal life, health experts urge states to look for infection rates and hospitalization to be on the decline for about 2 weeks. Here in Massachusetts, we're still seeing daily increases in positive cases and hospitalizations. And as I've said many times before, the surge arrives in different states and different regions of the United States at different times. Therefore, the process through which people will presume and move forward past the surge is going to vary depending upon when they actually see themselves in a situation where they see the kinds of declines that were talked about in the recommendations. We're working around the clock to expand our testing, to build a robust contact tracing network, and to get people well. And we're urging everyone at home to do your part and hang in there. We're also in discussion with other states and the business community to start building plans on how we can gradually and safely reopen the economy. In the meantime, please do your part and continue to abide by the many rules associated with social distance to stop the spread. Cover your face or wear a mask when you're out in public if you can't adequately social distance, because these things at the end of the day are the best tool we have to stop the virus and the spread. As your governor, I'm always going to put the needs of Massachusetts first. Working with other states is an important part of making sure that we understand what they're up to and they understand what we're up to, so that nobody gets surprised. And we'll continue to fight full force so that we can move back toward normalcy when it's appropriate to do so. There's no doubt we will recover and we will see brighter days. And the spirit of this great Commonwealth will not fade. And in fact, I'm pretty sure it will come back stronger than ever. Thank you. With that, I'd like to turn the mic over to Lieutenant Governor, talk a little more about domestic violence shelters and the work we're doing with them.
Thank you, Governor, and good afternoon. As we discussed last week, while these last few weeks have been incredibly difficult for all of us, they have left survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence particularly vulnerable and at an increased risk. We continue to work with our partners at community provider organizations statewide and are grateful for their efforts and their work and their tireless efforts and work as they expand services and support remotely and in whatever way it takes for survivors during this crisis. Working together, we are strengthening the safety net that covers our Commonwealth's communities and is the response to the needs of survivors and domestic violence victims. As the governor mentioned, we have established 5 isolation and recovery sites across our state to give people who have tested positive for COVID-19 and are experiencing homelessness a safe place to isolate and recover. The Department of Housing and Community Development and the Department of Public Health have instituted practices outlined by the CDC to mitigate COVID-19 outbreaks within congregate shelters. And shelter coordinators have implemented health screening procedures during the placement and the intake process. Part of this population also includes domestic violence survivors. And this week, DPH shared guidance on the isolation and recovery shelters with domestic violence shelters and their providers across the Commonwealth, and informed them that the survivors currently within their shelters will also have access to these facilities. These sites are for both individuals who are homeless and for domestic violence survivors that have tested positive for COVID-19 and are already in a domestic violence shelter. In coordination with providers and Jane Doe, we are working to ensure that the services someone is receiving in a domestic violence shelter are preserved. This includes providing domestic violence safety planning for survivors in the isolation and recovery shelters. The shelters will also make on-site coordination available for domestic violence-specific services and will address potential shared resources among providers to support a regional approach for domestic violence support at each site. We want to thank our providers. We want to thank Jane Doe for working with us to provide these services during this crisis. Case management and planning for discharging survivors will be coordinated between staff at the Isolation and Recovery Center and the survivor's domestic violence shelter or community-based support system. We will continue to work on more ways to provide resources and additional support for domestic violence and sexual assault survivors. And as I said last week, as part of the work we are doing to stop the spread of COVID-19 and all the efforts we are bringing forth across our Commonwealth, survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence will remain top of mind. You are not forgotten. We have expanded the capacity of our domestic violence hotline called SafeLink to also triage calls from our rape crisis centers. This resource connects survivors to our trained advocates specializing in crisis intervention, support, safety planning, and will make a warm handoff to our local providers. If you have experienced sexual assault or domestic violence within your home, or you're concerned about someone or a loved one who is experiencing this abuse or experiencing violence, please call SafeLink. Use the hotline for support and resource. That toll-free number is 877-785-2020. And for hearing impaired, the number is 877-521-2601. I want to reiterate, if you are at home with someone who has sexually or physically abused you and you have a moment of privacy, you make these calls. If you're in an emergency, you call or text 911. And if you cannot safely call or you don't feel comfortable in your surroundings to make a call, you can instant message trained advocates at the National Domestic Violence Hotline and or through the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. I'd like to close by saying thank you to all who are providing services in this area. Thank you to our community and local officials. I spend a lot of my day texting, calling, sharing, and exchanging information with our local government partners on many remote conference calls, often back to back, like many of you. And I just, as the governor has said before, we as a Commonwealth are only so strong as the 351 cities and towns that make up our great state. We are enormously grateful for the city managers and town managers and mayors and school committee members and select boards who are literally working arm in arm together within their regions of the Commonwealth, but in partnership with state government. Our constant connection, our sharing of information and resources, our collaboration and partnership are helping us get through and push through this crisis. We are enormously grateful and keep up your really good work. I'd like to now turn it over to Secretary Setters.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and particularly for all your work with victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, and our provider community. So just a few updates from the command center. And it goes as the governor was talking and the lieutenant governor was talking about how important it is to provide safe space for individuals who are homeless or experiencing domestic violence. I want to talk a little bit about food security and nutrition. So the COVID-19 pandemic has greatly impacted a family's financial stability across the Commonwealth, as you know. In addition to rising unemployment numbers, we have seen increasing food benefit applications for SNAP and WIC, two of our very basic safety net programs that provide financial assistance to help families purchase food. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, provides a monthly benefit to buy foods via electronic benefit transfer card, we refer to as the EBT card. Prior to the current public health crisis, 1 in 9 Massachusetts residents received SNAP benefits. Since the beginning of March, DTA has seen the weekly average of SNAP applications increase by nearly 400%. That is from about 4,000 to 17,000 applications. SNAP caseload is now about 475,000 individuals, up from 436,000 on March 6th. WIC, the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, otherwise known as WIC, is a nutrition program that provides healthy foods, nutrition, education, and counseling, breastfeeding support, and referrals to other health and social services free of charge to Massachusetts families who qualify. WIC similarly provides benefits to recipients on the EBT cards. As you know, WIC serves pregnant women and new mothers, infants, and children up to the age of 5. Families already receiving SNAP, TANF, and many other types of MassHealth are automatically eligible for WIC. While SNAP and WIC have applied flexibility to program operations, moving services entirely online processing rising applications efficiently and remotely. There continues to be demand for these programs during the pandemic, which is why it's important to remind people that they may be eligible for SNAP and WIC. As you know, we continue to explore flexibilities to meet the needs of households during this trying time, including from DTA. We've received approval to issue SNAP payments to bring families' benefits up to the maximum monthly amount for those families who had not been receiving the maximum benefit amount. We've received approval from the USDA to extend certification periods for 6 months. And we've received approval to modify the application process by foregoing the traditional in-person interview. This enhances our ability to process applications as quickly as possible. And no, we do not have a backlog. While DTA offices are closed to in-person services, applicants and clients are able to connect with DT online and over the phone for all services. Potential clients can check their eligibility in about 10 seconds. Clients can check their case status, see an EBT card balance, upload and submit documents and more on dtaconnect.com. And Project Bread's Food Source Hotline offers free comprehensive statewide food assistance available in 160 languages. And there was a question that came up the other day about online food purchases using EBT cards. And as many people know, EBT cards have generally not been allowable under federal SNAP rules for online food purchases. So additional food items have been added to the WIC's allowable food list to support better availability on grocery store shelves. It's very important that we assure everyone that you have access to food during this time. And finally, Massachusetts will be submitting a waiver request to the USDA by the end of next week in order for us to allow EBT vendors and their two currently authorized online vendors so that we can have online purchasing and possibly even individuals who are on SNAP benefits be able to pick up their groceries, as many of us do, sort of as the deliveries can come out to the car. That's not been something available for us. So there have been four states who have submitted requests and have been approved to participate in this pilot, and again, we will be applying for that shortly. And finally, knowing how important food security is and the economic fallout from the COVID-19 public health crisis, we will be standing up in the command center a centralized task force to provide coordination of all of our state's resources, strategically addressing gaps and fostering communication to ensure food insecurity and food supply needs are addressed in an efficient manner. We will include representatives, of course, the very important MEMA, MassHealth, MDAR, DPH, DTA, and all of our very important community partners. It's very important because we know how important the basic necessities will be as we go through this period of time. And finally, some of you may not have noticed, but the governor signed an executive order yesterday authorizing the Department of Early Education and Care to establish emergency sites for children and youth living in residential homes that have tested positive for COVID-19 and need to be cared for in quarantine or isolation. EEC is responsible for the licensing and oversight of residential programs and group homes, providing 24-hour custodial care and social services to children served by many public agencies. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we will be These programs, as you know, remain open, our 24/7 congregate care throughout the state, and will continue to do so. Some existing facilities do not have the capability to effectively isolate and quarantine individuals who have been exposed or tested positive for COVID-19. The goal of the temporary emergency residential sites, which we will be standing up, is to accommodate the needs of COVID-19 exposed youth who cannot stay in their current residential placement. The order gives EEC the authority to open temporary emergency residential programs that are better suited to care for residents who need to be quarantined and isolated, and provide appropriate flexibility around licensing regulations to prevent the spread of COVID-19 while keeping the educators, staff, children, and youth safe. Any provider interested in operating a temporary emergency residential site may apply on the EEC COVID-19 website. I'll turn this back over to the governor. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing at the State House.
The states have to step up their testing. I wonder, you were on that call with him yesterday. Do you need anything from the federal government to support testing in Massachusetts, like funding? And also, how much of the population in Massachusetts needs to be tested before the state can even consider reopening?
Well, the first thing I'd point out about testing, and it's a significant issue, is all the testing protocols, all the materials, all the processes appropriately need to be signed off and approved by the CDC and the FDA. And that is as it should be. And there are two kinds of testing that are getting most of the attention at the moment. One kind of testing is the sort we think of now, which is the sort of swab-based testing that's currently done. Some of it can be done by a clinician. They then take the test and they give it to somebody in their organization who gives it to a courier who then takes it to a lab and it gets processed to the lab and then the results come back from that test. That is how the vast majority of our tests are currently processed. There are also tests that can be done using sort of desktop testing devices. They take maybe 15 minutes or so. Isn't that about what the one out in Lowell is using? The difference between those test devices and the ones that get taken out is the labs, obviously, over the course of an evening, can do tens of thousands of tests. If you ran these smaller machines all day long, you can divide by four and figure out you can do four an hour, basically, if it takes 15 minutes to process. And that's not counting the time associated with collecting the specimens and all the rest. And there's still some issues with the desktop stuff around the way the test is actually done. And in some cases, getting back to a point that Bruce raised yesterday, in some cases, depending upon how the test is done, you are either very likely to get the right answer, or in some cases, you may get a false negative. I think the more traditional long swab has been proven to be sort of 95%+ accurate. So there are issues associated with the front end of testing that are going to require the CDC and the FDA to approve more kinds of testing and to enhance and ensure the reliability associated with that testing. If we really want to get to the point where we're testing as much as we would like and as most other governors in most other states would like, there needs to be more testing infrastructure, more test kits, more capacity to test. And I don't think you're going to find a governor in the United States who feels differently about that than on that issue. The second kind of testing that people have started to talk about is antibody testing, which is this idea that you test people with a pinprick, and based on their pinprick, you can determine if, in fact, their body has generated the antibodies that you would generate if you fought off the virus. And one of the reasons why antibody testing matters is because a significant number of the people who get infected with COVID-19 don't ever show symptoms. So if there's a significant number of people who haven't shown symptoms but have, in fact, contracted the virus, developed the antibodies, they are, in many respects, every bit as immune for some period of time as the people who actually get sick. Their bodies build up the antibodies, they fight it off, and they obviously would test positive on the antibody test as well. The reason both tests matter is over time, what you really want is a sense about how many people have actually had the virus and are immune for some period of time, and on that one, there's still research that has to be done to figure out how long you stay immune. Remember, if you get the flu, you're not supposed to get it twice in a season, but if it comes back in a different flavor the next year, it's possible you'll get it the next year when it comes back, which is why people get flu shots on an annualized basis. But I think the The long story short here is whether you're talking about the antibody test, which I think everybody agrees will be helpful but still needs work, or you're talking about the more traditional test on the front end, which is just the standard way of determining whether people have it or not, which is the test we've been using, I think most governors would say we need to do a lot more of that. And we are constantly talking to the players in the test community about, and in the lab community, about increasing capacity. But some of the work associated with increasing capacity is going to require the CDC and the FDA to do more. And I've made clear on calls with governors, I've made clear on calls with federal officials, I've made clear on calls with almost everybody that I talk to about this stuff for the past few weeks, that if there is going to be another federal endeavor that comes on the heels of the three stimulus bills, they absolutely, positively need to include in that significant resources for the CDC and the FDA to up their game, because they are a major player in establishing a far more significant testing capacity in the United States. Remember, part of the reason we're building up this tracing program, this contact tracing program, which I believe is going to be critical to our ability to identify and contain COVID on a go-forward basis, one of the elements that makes this work is an enhanced capacity to test. So if you were to say to me, does testing matter? My answer is absolutely. Are we going to do more to ensure that we test, continue to grow our testing capability? You bet. But I also believe that it's going to be important for the CDC and the FDA to have additional resources so that they, who are in fact the gating agent with respect to approval process and all the rest, they got to be part of the answer too. Well, keep in mind that I do think the general guidance, if you look at other parts of the world, the general guidance with respect to seeing a decline in hospitalizations, a decline in positive tests, that has been, for all intents and purposes, the way most other countries have gone about establishing a criteria that suggests that your social distancing, your stay-at-home advisories, your limits on gatherings, that all those things you've done to stop the spread have actually started to have a positive impact. But you got to have a lot of testing protocol in place going forward to ensure that if there is an issue, you have the contact tracing mechanism in place to contain it, and that you have all the issues associated with social distance, hygiene, and all the rest as part of whatever your world looks like when you open back up. You can't just open it back up and have it look exactly like it did before. That won't work.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House.
Well, I got to go with the guidance that they put out yesterday. If you read the guidance that was put out by the administration, which was built off the task force that was appointed by the president, the task force and the guidance make absolutely clear that different states are in different places with respect to the surge, with respect to the impact that COVID's had on their states, and that states need to drive the process with respect to reopening. I mean, there's no way you can read that and interpret anything other than that. So as far as I'm concerned, that means we should work together with our colleagues in the Northeast, make sure we don't surprise each other with respect to the decisions that we make, and be very careful once we get past the surge and we have 14 days of declining positive tests and not make decisions about this in a vacuum.
Governor, do you expect to take that one step further when it's time to open up Massachusetts and maybe open up regionally within Massachusetts, certain parts, certain counties?
We haven't gotten that far down the road in our discussions yet, but when the Lieutenant Governor and Secretary Sutters and I and others have talked about this, we've always talked about it as a process that's got to be iterative and careful and well communicated. And it's got to be one where you can absolutely positively measure what's going on in something pretty close to real time.
Governor, when you talk about antibody testing in the state,
Say again.
You've been talking about the antibody testing to see if people are immune. On the flip side, how much testing is there being done in Massachusetts for the 1,200 plus people who have already died who have tested positive to see what is in their blood or anything, if there's anything that can be learned from that information or some of the vaccines that are being created?
Do you want to take a run at that one? I certainly know that there are states that don't test everybody. We test everybody. So we know a lot more about who actually had COVID than who didn't. But do you want to speak to the rest of that?
So actually a number of our reported deaths are individuals who died as persons under investigation. It wasn't until after they died that we actually confirmed that they were COVID positive. So in Massachusetts, we actually, unlike in some other states, if someone dies with the symptoms of upper respiratory illnesses, we actually do the test, which is one of the reasons why you see the significant proportion of people who've died from long-term care facilities and nursing homes.
But are you using the information from?
So I don't know if we actually take whether blood samples, and I will check with the Department of Public Health. I don't know whether we take the blood samples. Other than I know that what we do test people. So we'll have to get back to you on that one.
Secretary,
I can also just tell you that I've talked to the leaders of a number of the companies that are working on both therapies and on vaccines pretty regularly, because some of them have either existing footprints in Massachusetts or are headquartered in Massachusetts. And I've basically said to them, if there's anything you need from us, you just need to ask. They have not asked for that. They've asked for other stuff. But my view on this stuff is if you've got companies that are part of the community that are actually working on either treatments or vaccines that people believe have promise, we're going to stay in close contact with them. And if there are things we can do to help them, we're going to help them. But that's a good example of what I mean by the CDC and the FDA absolutely positively should be part of whatever the next act is at the federal level, because it's companies like that that are going to need the FDA and the CDC to have their full attention as they move forward on their preclinical and their clinical trials and everything else that's associated with getting to the point where they can actually start to manufacture and distribute.
Governor, for families in congregate shelter settings where maybe no one is tested positive, if they have a child or a parent at high risk, are there any additional resources or guidelines anywhere they could stay, or do you hope that these guidelines will help keep them spread out?
Okay.
So we have asked all congregate care shelters, family shelters, they are allowed to set up additional, I think the governor said, setting up additional apartments. Scattered site apartments for individuals who want to be distanced. So we've done that across all the family shelters. There's a weekly phone call with all the family shelters about what resources they need. Daniel Ferrier from Heading Home, who used to be a public official in the Department of Children and Families, has put forth a recommendation about if a single parent, becomes COVID-19, how to take care for their parents. And we're vetting that with our provider community. So again, trying to find additional resources to ensure that people are safe, their children are safe, and they have the food that they need.
Secretary, we've seen in Colorado and Ohio.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing at the State House.
So I haven't seen the Colorado and Ohio. I do sort of do scans when I have time about what other states are reporting. We are expecting to sometime next week we're going to be, as we continue to update our daily reports, we're going to be consolidating a number of our reports into more of a like visual dashboards, if you would, and we'll be including nursing home information in that.
So there's an ongoing conversation between our administration, and that's myself, the Lieutenant Governor, Education Commissioner Jeff Riley, and Secretary of Education Jim Pizer, with mayors and city managers and select boards and superintendents and school committees about the rest of the school year. And honestly, if you could wave a magic wand, which we can't, I believe that the vast majority of school systems and school district leaders would like to see the kids back at some point before the end of the year for two reasons. Number one, to be able to do some competency testing and figure out what the gaps may be that a lot of kids are going to have because they haven't gone to school for the most part for the past month and a half and may not go for some time going forward. So that there's some idea about things people could work on over the course of the summer so they're not completely behind when they show up again in the fall. And the second thing is to just have a chance to settle people in and talk a little bit about the next year. But the challenges associated with that are real, and we've been back and forth with them about this now for most of the last 3 or 4 weeks, and we get the fact that a decision needs to be made soon, that people need to have clarity around this, and we'll make one shortly.
What would that even look like if students were returning to school? I mean, how would that look? Would kids have to have their temperatures taken every day?
No, that's a big part of what the conversation's been about. How hard would it be to actually create a framework that would work?
Governor, you said 2 weeks of declining...
Say again?
You talked about 2 weeks of declining...
test results. That's part of the guidance from the report that was put out yesterday by the administration.
So the numbers now bounce around a lot.
They do.
And so are you saying a steady decline for 2 weeks?
That's pretty much what they were talking about, yeah.
Okay. So that'll be very tough. That would take a while.
We've talked about that, yeah.
And one other nerdy question. Your office said they didn't have yesterday the National Guard testing.
I'm sorry, ask me the question again, Bruce.
So the National Guard is going around testing nursing homes. You rattle off numbers usually about how many they tested, but you don't say how many are turning out to be positive with those tests. Is that extremely high percentage?
You know me, I never speculate. I like to give, when I give my numbers, I like them to be very factual. So let me double check, and we will call you back today.
I would imagine that the numbers on that would be reasonably high because they're pretty strategic. I mean, when we do that testing, it's typically based on where the people at the facilities believe we should test, which is part of the reason why we're there in the first place. I mean, they have particular wings or units or whatever it is that they say they really want us to test, and that's where we go. So my guess is I'm guessing that the positives there are probably pretty high. You haven't been here for a couple of days, because I have talked about the fact that the spread on this may last a little longer, depending upon the nature of how this hill looks. But I certainly believed several weeks ago that it was going to be somewhere between the 7th or the 17th or the 10th or the 20th or somewhere in that general vicinity. And we've talked for the last several days about the idea that we think we are in the surge. How long it lasts is hard to predict. But I do think we are, for all intents and purposes, in the place we thought we would be when we put together the plan to expand our capacity, reduce our existing occupancy, to create room both for COVID-positive people, but also to make sure, and I want to repeat this, that we would have the capacity in our healthcare system to continue to do all the things that it does with respect to people who have strokes or cancer or cardiac arrest or any of that sort of thing. I mean, a big part of this whole strategy was about making sure that the healthcare community would be able to not just take care of the folks who were dealing with the trauma associated with COVID, but that the system and the community would be able to deal with all the other stuff that it deals with on a regular basis. And I think the fact that we're sitting here several days into an increase in COVID admissions with roughly half the hospital system with available capacity speaks to the fact that we did a pretty good job of setting this thing up in a way that would make it possible for us to deal with the surge. But this is an unprecedented event. The other thing we've said is it's very hard to predict exactly how long it will last, because that depends to some extent on the nature of what the, you know, what the run-up and the run-down looks like. But I think our view is we're about where we thought we would be.
Are we still on the upward slope?
I think so. But if you look at the daily data, it would imply that we are. Yeah.
But it doesn't look like the hospitals are in a position right now. I mean, they're not so small, but to be completely overwhelmed.
No, but that was part of the plan, was to try to make sure that when we got to this point, we would have the hospital capacity that we would need to not just treat COVID folks, but also to be able to take care of all the other issues. I mean, one of the biggest challenges in other countries and, frankly, in other places around the U.S. has been getting so overwhelmed by COVID that they don't have the ability to deal with the stuff that they normally deal with. And we did not want to be in that situation. We wanted, if people needed to get certain kinds of care that wasn't about COVID, to be able to access it and get it. And I think in some respects, people did a good job of building up a model here that's going to make it possible for us to do both.
Sorry, on EBT, what's the status of curbside pickup? I know that's usually an online order.
I think that's what she asked about, she talked about.
Clear on. Is that something an EBT recipient can?
No, not currently. So we're requesting a waiver. That's part of the waiver, so that we can do both online and then have curbside pickup.
How long would that take between when the waiver is granted or the application process for the waiver, when a recipient can actually do that?
Well, since you know I'm such a patient person, the application is supposed to be in no later than the 24th of April. The federal government has been very quick in turning around applications. Certainly through HHS and the like. So we're expecting, so we're using a template that several other states used. So I'm hoping that we get sort of a quick approval. It will take a couple of weeks, 2 to 4 weeks, to actually get it set up. But again, we think it's the right thing for us to pursue for individuals in order to ensure that people have food and the like, and particularly for individuals for whom traveling to grocery stores, as we all know, it takes much longer now to go to grocery stores. And like, if you have a disability, if you're blind, you know, particularly if you have a lot of kids, it's a challenge. So we're trying to create the flexibilities so people have the basic necessities that they need. Thanks.
Is there anything to do in that 2 to 4 weeks, Matt? Anything the state could do in the meantime?
As you know, this is a federally regulated program. So what we're going to do is get the application in as soon as possible, be assertive in our advocacy to get it, and then implement it as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Secretary, the numbers that you put out daily and sometimes weekly, I know you guys have done a lot of work to provide a racial and ethnic breakdown of those cases. Is there any work to give a breakdown of how much testing is done by county to make sure there aren't any regional disparities or any issues like that?
So, we're trying to, we continue to improve upon our data, and next week we will be putting out the data in what I would call like a data book with graphs and charts and as much county level data that we can put out that is, I want to ensure everything's factual and accurate. So I think next week we will roll out, I think what'll be, as you know, it's been a lot of different data sources, and we try to get out as quickly as possible. I know for all of you it was never as quick as it should be, as fast enough. So we're trying to now really bring the data together in like a data book that would be published every day for you to have. So.
Thank you, everyone. Got to get going. Going to Swampscott, I don't know if you've ever been in the Whole Foods, but we did get that press release today that a Whole Foods employee had passed away. I didn't know if you wanted to say anything about that, even if you live in the town and everything.
So, My daughter is a Whole Foods shopper. I'm more of a Stop and Shop shopper, but it doesn't really matter because the story here is the same story I've spoken of a number of times, which is somebody who is an essential worker who took that role seriously, who was part of a community that made it possible for other people to access a necessity, right? And I don't know if they have a family. I don't know if their family's here. I don't know anything about them other than they are someone who stepped up at a time when a lot of people have stepped up. And I'm sure for his or her loved ones, this is going to be one of the worst experiences they've ever had. And I've said before, and I think about this a lot, the COVID-19 is an insidious disease. And I use that word for a very particular reason. There are a lot of people who have it, who are carriers, who never know they have it. It's invisible. And because of the contagion, it makes it virtually impossible when it strikes and takes someone away for people to be able to pay their respects in a proper manner. And part of what we did to limit the occupancy in grocery stores and put programming in place around shifts people could work or shifts people could choose not to work, and the stuff we did around social distancing and so many of the other orders we've issued. We've issued so many executive orders and emergency orders at this point, we're actually not even using the official yellow paper I'm supposed to use them on anymore because we used it all up. All of that stuff has been about trying to come up with policies and procedures that make it possible for people to work their way through this. And when I say work in that case, I don't mean work. I mean just manage their way through it. And for that person and for their coworkers and their family and their friends, this is the worst of all possible things. And the way COVID works just makes it that much more brutal.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is WBUR, and I'm Tiziana Deering of Radio Boston. We've been bringing you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House. A number of areas of focus today, including increased rates of testing over time, capacity of beds, as well as a significant focus today on vulnerable populations, whether that be people who are homeless, people who need WIC or SNAP support, foster families, and children who are living in congregate homes.